Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of medical debate, discussion, science, and healthcare, and can we escape it, politics in the news, as well as answers to your emails and phone calls. Also, coming up in the mid-part of the show, we'll have a couple of guests, and we will be talking a little bit about palliative care, also on that subject of end of life. I've got an announcement coming up on September 9th, 10th, and 11th at the Cabrillo Crocker Theater in Aptos. My dear friend Tandy Beal and John Scoville's piece, Here After Here, which is kind of a tour with song and dance of eternity. What happens when we cross over, and what is in fact there an afterlife? Well, if you'd like to come, you can call the Cabrillo College box office, or you can I don't have a website here, but I bet you if you search Here After Here, it'll come right up. Oh, here it is, santacruztickets.com, or call the Civic Center box office, 831-420-5260. Another cool thing that's coming up in the community is a class on nutrition for life. This is starting September 6th is the first class. It's a 4-class course at New Leaf Community Market, sponsored by the Cancer Project. We had them on the air a little while ago, Sandy and her interesting ideas about how maybe we can prevent cancer and certainly keep our cured cancers from coming back by just eating right and stocking up on those antioxidants. She knows all about it, and you can too. They've reduced the price in the class. It's $90 for 4 classes, and you can find out about that by going to cancerproject.org/classes. Now, before we go any further, I need to do some disclaimers. The opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. And the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Before we go to emails and then later on to our guests, I want to turn you on to an article that was published in The Nation. Author is Matt Stoller. And Matt really wasn't talking so much about a healthcare issue, but he was talking about the effects of the flat earth. The world is flat concept was supposed to be all good, but, you know, there are some problems. And part of what has happened is that we have gone into this worldwide competitive bidding thing for our sourcing. Those of you who were listening last week may remember a discussion of how that's drastically affected the potentially, at least, the quality of the raw materials for drugs. That's a little bit scary. In Matt Stoller's article, he also points out that we have created a situation where we are very vulnerable to industrial shocks. The nuclear power plant blows up in Japan, and suddenly auto parts are short everywhere. There's a book discussing this in detail written by Barry Lynn of the New America Foundation. That's talked about in this. And essentially what is happening with all sorts of production is that you go where the raw materials and the cheap labor is. And that's fine as long as you don't have a problem with transportation. Of course, this whole economic structure is fueled by cheap petroleum because you have to move this stuff. And that's also engineering into our supply chain a great vulnerability. But so far this year, this isn't a big picture, might happen someday. So far this year, there have been critical shortages of over 180 drugs that are crucial for the treatment of leukemia, breast and colon cancer, and several infections. This is a record number. Prices, when these drugs become scarce, prices go up 20 or 30 fold. Clinical trials have to be delayed, and people who are currently getting chemotherapy are unable to get their drug and may have to switch to a different agent halfway through their chemo, something we never do, and we honestly have no idea whether or not that will impact the person's success. The Obama administration is creating a government stockpile of crucial cancer medicines. CDC already stockpiles antibiotics and antidotes and things we would need for a terrorist attack or an earthquake, but no one's really thought about the timing of cancer therapy and how shortages of these medicines would affect things. But we really do have an issue as the large generic manufacturers consolidate. When you consolidate, that means you've taken on a lot of debt to buy other companies. The first thing you do is eliminate duplication. That's if you're a corporation. Well, that makes sense. Duplication is waste. That wasted money can go somewhere else. The problem is duplication, especially distributed over different geographical areas, is also safety. But safety doesn't pay dividends. So we are really, really pinning ourselves into a corner. What I'd like to suggest to my audience is if you are taking a medication that is really life critical for you, that you really need to have a supply, you want at least a month's backlog of this. And that may cost you out of pocket. Think of that as your rainy day insurance policy. If your doctor says you cannot go off this medication without serious adverse consequences, well, then you need to have that medication such that if there were an earthquake and the pharmacies closed or whatever, you would not be trapped. And a month's supply is a nice long supply, which would allow for some of these global shortages. Eventually, people figure out, oh, I've got a bunch in the warehouse and I can release it. And maybe a month is just about enough time for things to get back on their feet. So I'm strongly recommending that if you have meds that are important on you, you keep some in backup. And when those outdate, then replace them. Use that for your prescription that last month before it outdates. And then you replace it with that prescription you wouldn't have been taking. I hope I was clear about that. But don't keep outdated drugs around. Use them while they're still good and just keep feeding forward so you've got some on backup. This is really important. And yes, I know it costs money and you may not get reimbursed by your insurance. But right now, the way things are, I think it's an important safety step. We're going to go to one caller, Gary from Soquel. Hello, Gary. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Dawn. Okay. Well, I have a question about GERD. I'm taking ranitidine and omeprazole and I just have symptoms at night, and I have Barrett's esophagus, and I've had all the upper endoscopies and all that good stuff. And I also don't eat any foods that provoke, that cause pain in my esophagus, all the chocolate and spicy foods and ginger and tomatoes and all that stuff.
When was your Barrett's biopsy done?
Well, I've had several done in the last 6 years. I have them done about every 2 years.
And on the last evaluation, you still had Barrett's?
Right.
Okay, go ahead. What's your question?
Two questions. Well, actually three. I'm also taking slippery elm and marshmallow as sort of a healing drink, and that doesn't seem to be helping too much. But I'm wondering about surgery, number one. Number two, corrective surgery. Number two, I mostly just take one ranitidine or one omeprazole per evening. Once in a while, I'll have to take two to get through the night. I don't take any during the day because I don't need it. And so surgery, is it okay to alternate these ranitidine and omeprazole?
Yes, it is okay to alternate. And the omeprazole does require a somewhat acid environment to absorb. So if you have a little bit of acid intake, you'll absorb it. If there's absolutely no acid in your system, the omeprazole doesn't actually dissociate or absorb very well. Alternating is therefore not such a bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
It also allows for a little bit of acid, which will tend to mitigate the problem we get into with long-term use of proton pump inhibitors, which is that you grow more acid-producing cells as a response to not being allowed to make acid and not seeing any acid in your stomach. Your stomach stimulates the parietal cells to divide and you end up with more acid-producing cells, which worsens the problem in the long run. And that's part of the fix we've gotten ourselves into with these agents. That being said, Barrett's esophagus is a serious condition. You have a 15-fold, that's 1,500% chance of cancer greater than the general population. So that's not to be sneezed at. The surgery I presume you're referring to is a Nissen fund application. This is a surgery where an artificial valve is created. Often the stomach might be above the diaphragm and that's pulled down and a little pleat is made to act like an additional barrier for the esophageal sphincter. These fund applications do reduce the risk of cancer in the long run. They last about 10 to 15 years, and then things stretch back out again, so it's not a permanent fix. But it might be good to consider it.
And is it called fundoplication?
That's, I'm assuming, the surgery you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And the other thing I would say is adding deglycerized licorice would be a good idea.
I do that. I find that there's just one DGL that is lower in sugar. The other one, sugar aggravates GERD.
Right.
And I just take the one that's the least sugary.
That's good. So I think you're doing all of the good things that you should be doing. Also, maybe should be taking a half baby aspirin or a half an aspirin at least a day. I know that's counterintuitive, but that data that I've talked about 2 weeks ago on cancer reduction with aspirin included esophageal cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can get it down there without irritating you, you might consider it.
Or half a baby aspirin.
Just a baby aspirin, yes.
One, okay, I'll get some baby aspirin.
Yeah,
I think so. My inner child.
Yes, well, your inner child is still in there fighting to get out. Have I answered your questions?
Yes, you've been
okay,
very helpful.
Really good. I want to read a email, this one from Mark in San Jose. Mark's a electronic engineer, and he called to respond to our discussion of smart meters and cellular phones for a couple of weeks. Like any good geek, Mark listens to the podcasts, so he recognizes that we're discussing a topic that's a couple of weeks old. He had, however, an interesting take on it. He mentioned something that I was not aware of, but apparently when you are standing near a cell phone tower and you're talking on your headset, then what you have is you're very, very close to the cell phone tower. And in that situation, your cell phone is actually sending out a little tiny signal. Whereas if you're far away from the cell phone tower, it's sending out a big signal. Thus, ironically, it's possible that the safest place to be is right next to a cell phone tower. I'm not sure about this. There's some other considerations. I welcome your comments. Okay, so now we're going to try and move to our guest. First, let's talk with Kathy Conway, Director of Community Programs at Hospice of Santa Cruz County. Okay, we've got Kathy on the line. So we were going to talk a little bit about hospice, and it looks like we are unable to do the dual conversation that we thought this board was capable of, but we are soon to have better equipment here. So, Kathy, we're going to start with you, and we won't be able to have our three-way dialogue, but we'll get Debbie back on the line, and then we'll turn the conversation over to her as well. But let's just start, Kathy, with a discussion of how does hospice exactly make dying easier? I think that's what most of us think it's supposed to do. And I think a few people maybe still harbor fears that there's actually a euthanasia component. We both know that's not true, and I'm going to say that right away. Hospice doesn't kill people, but it does make dying easier in other ways. Tell us about the main ways in your experience that hospice can help people with terminal disease.
Sure. And Dr. Don, thank you so much for having us on. It's unfortunate that we can't get both of us on, and this is a great question for Debbie as well, as Chief Clinical Officer. And
I will ask it.
Yeah, and a registered nurse. She sees this more firsthand. But I can tell you the experiences I've had with talking with our families and talking with patients who've been on hospice service. The way hospice makes that dying process easier, it's really looking at the patient and the family as a unit of care. How is that different from the general care that they may get off of hospice care? Is that we're looking at not just the medical, but the medical, the emotional, the spiritual care that a patient and their family need at the end of life. So it's really looking at that group together and helping certainly manage pain and symptoms that the patient might be having, but really looks into asking other questions, how the family's doing with this, how everyone understands the disease process happening, what the patient's goals for care might be.
What sort of help can you offer to the family? I'm interested in what people need.
Well, there's so many things that come up at the end of life concerns. Chaplain is available to help not only talk to the patient about what they think is happening as their life progresses, but also help the family members get a better understanding of what's happening, what they may think happens at the end of life, which is really tying into the work that Tandy Beal is doing. We're just so thrilled that she's opening up these conversations. But a lot of times just helping people have the conversations about what's happening and what's going to be happening next. The other thing hospice can help with are hospice aides. You know, the people who are in there, they see about 6 patients and families a day. They help with care like changing sheets, bathing patients, helping with the personal care. And sometimes that can just be overwhelming to family members who want to care for their loved one at home but might not have kind of the skills to do that. You know, we're so competent, most of us in our daily lives, with so many things, but caring for someone we love who's dying at home is something that many of us are not familiar with. And so I see the hospice team as really kind of normalizing that process and helping people to feel confident that they know what to do in caring for somebody that they love in their home at the end of life.
Well, I would think that, at least my circumstances as a primary care doctor, there's one scenario that I see a lot, and I want you to comment on it. And this is typically the male husband is ill, cancer or other neurodegenerative disease like ALS, I can think of in one case. Mm-hmm. And in these circumstances, men are likely to become somewhat reclusive and just kind of want to go into their cave and be left alone.
Mm-hmm.
That means bringing a stranger into the house becomes a big bone of contention. And I have seen the wives of such people knock themselves to the point of actual physical illness, trying to take care of the house, take care of all the needs, which can be extreme. And particularly as things get bad, the husband may not even be safe on his own. So it's not even possible to go out and do the grocery shopping and take care of any external chores because you have to be there all the time because he's afraid he might die by himself.
Right.
But at the same time, there's no opportunity to have any life of one's own. And I see the caregivers falling into a very, very bad physical state.
Right.
I wonder, how do you get people to give permission to allow their wife to get a break? Because that's a tough one. I've had great difficulty getting that to happen.
Yeah, it's certainly a challenge for some patients and families to open up and be ready to accept the help that's available. What I've heard from so many patients over the years and family members, mostly the family members, after they've had the experience with hospice, is they'll say, if I knew how much you could help our family, I would have called sooner.
Maybe you should do some outreach to your ex-hospice families and give them little referral cards to hand out along with a slight testimonial. It might make more sense as a marketing strategy.
Right. Well, as you say that, it's very true. People who have been through hospice care, the family members who have been through hospice care, that's when they really get it. Mm-hmm. It's hard to quite understand how much hospice can help if you're not in that situation.
Okay, well, we're going to invite the people out there listening, if there is anyone who cares to call and weigh in on the hospice topic this hour, we'll be sure to give you priority in the queue. Any last comments before we switch to Debbie, points that you wanted to be sure we made?
Just one thing I wanted to bring up because you mentioned Tandy's show at the opening of your show. And we're just so excited that Tandy's doing this because, you know, this is a difficult, death and dying are difficult topics and difficult conversations to have. We find people don't like to talk about death so much. And when something like art helps us explore these topics, it's just such an opening. And mm-hmm. Tandy's show is just a thought-provoking, really beautiful show that starts to help people have conversations about what happens at the end of life and beyond. And one of the nights, the Friday night, is a benefit for Hospice of Santa Cruz County. So if you're interested or your listeners are interested in the benefit, they can call Hospice at 430-3082, and the benefit tickets are $50 and include a reception before the show. But there's many things scheduled around that, different talks that you can find out on our website, hospicesantacruz.org, and on Tandy's website, that is helping open up conversations about preparing for the end of life, having advanced directives and your wishes in order and sharing those wishes, and all these things that we find are helpful to people as they near the end of life.
All right. Well, very good. Thank you. And we're going to flip over to Debbie for a while, okay?
Great.
Debbie Owen, are you there?
Good morning. Yes, I'm here.
Good morning. You're Chief Clinical Officer for Hospice, and I think you've been listening. So first thing I think I'll do is ask you if you wanted to respond to any of the previous questions.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I want to echo Kathy's appreciation for having us on this morning to be able to engage in a conversation about hospice. And the first question that you started with, how does hospice make dying easier? Kathy did an excellent job in explaining the concepts behind there, the fact that realizing death is more than just a physical experience and that it affects more than just the patient dying. And with your permission, I'd kind of like to share a couple of stories from my experience of that might illustrate that.
Go ahead.
One example deals with the physical that we think about a lot. And this was working with a gentleman who was a farmer. He was about 6'4". To look at him, you would think he was as healthy as a horse. But he actually had a very invasive cancer and had been experiencing a lot of pain. And to the second point you were making, when I walked in the day to introduce myself, he was sitting in his chair with his arms crossed saying, "So I don't really think that you're going to be able to do anything to help me, but you're only here because of her." And he kind of pointed his head over to his wife. You know, he sat down and basically said, "Maybe not, but what risk do you have listening and talking with me today?" And as a result of that and him allowing me at least to start the conversation, we were able to not only get his pain to an acceptable level to him, but because of that, he was able to engage more in the life and the time that he had left, and they were able to go on a camping trip that they had been planning for months that had been put on the back burner. So his engagement back with her and his coming to realize that hospice was not only there to support her during this time with him, but in fact went on after he was gone through our bereavement support, was comforting, not only for him, but to his wife. So that's kind of the physical aspect of controlling symptoms. And another experience that's always stayed with me, because it happened on the same afternoon, was an elderly lady I was working with, who was declining, and that afternoon she shared with me that she wished she could talk to her daughter. She knew she was getting close to the end of her life, and she wished she could talk to her daughter about it, and I encouraged her to do so, and then in kind of debriefing with her daughter about the care and the symptoms, her daughter that very same day said, "You know, I really would like to talk to my mom about what's going on, but I don't want her to think that I'm giving up on her or I want her to die." So sometimes just being that safe place to say words and to express feelings that allow people to connect then on those really important conversations that they're wanting to have with each other. But as Kathy said, they don't know how to start.
Okay, so facilitating communication and offering the opportunity to improve pain control such that people can have more ambulation, more activity, providing home care services such that you don't have one person on 24/7 nursing duty.
Sure.
Also, from my perspective, having boots on the ground, so to speak, in the home, mm-hmm. which is something as a physician that I just can't do. And knowing that if there is a problem, loose bath mats, need for more pain medications, a problem with constipation, which is a side effect of the pain medications, that there's someone who's coming in who has those problem-solving abilities and is going to keep the pain and suffering of the process to the minimum. Another thing as a physician that I have found really helpful is we don't know what death looks like in our society. It doesn't look like what the movies have. And with the education that hospice provides, I get calls from my patients' families now saying, "Okay, it looks like we're coming up to the end. He's doing that breathing thing." Mm-hmm. And they're not scared of it. They recognize it as part of agonal respiration. And they're not thinking that that represents pain or that that isn't just part of the tug of war between the various breathing control systems as the body shuts down.
That's an excellent point. And in fact, my first experience to hospice came many, many years ago when my father was diagnosed with cancer. And I can remember very clearly my question I kept asking everyone is, just tell me what to expect. Just tell me what's going to happen, because I was afraid of being caught off guard. And as you said, not knowing, is this normal? Is this abnormal? Should I be worried? Is this what happens? Because for most of us, this is the first time we've been up close and personal with something like this. So I thank you for highlighting that, because that I think is a really important way that we help the families, and also by having that collaboration with their primary physician, who's been a huge part of their care for their whole lifetime, is still a partner in this very important event.
Well, thank you very much, and I wondered if you would give out contact information for hospice.
Absolutely. Anyone who has questions is welcome to call us. Our phone number is 430-3000. Just call and say you have questions, and we'll get you directed to the right person. Whether those questions are about an active situation, you just want information, or maybe you're someone in the community who has had a death in their life already who would just like to talk to somebody about the grief you're feeling.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Thank you. And we will be posting the link on the website. It is hospicesantacruz.org. Had some interesting science stories this week, and I'm glad to have the opportunity to bring them to you. First of all, a bacteria found in fruit flies may be able to stop mosquitoes from transmitting the virus causing dengue fever. Dengue fever is a arthropod vector-borne illness, which is a particularly difficult thing to build a vaccine around. Dengue fever causes a flu-like illness, but in some cases it can cause a severe hemorrhagic fever with kidney shutdown and encephalitis and death. So we don't really want that floating around in the southeastern United States. And there have been, over the last years, as a result of global climate change, increasing cases of this hitherto unknown disease on our shores. Researchers infected female mosquitoes with a bacterium called Wolbachia. It was found to block the transmission of the dengue virus, and the strain, basically they used female mosquitoes, and they reproduced, and after several generations, the entire group of mosquitoes in that test populations were infected with this bacteria. And they think they may have found a bacterial way to block it. The mosquitoes don't become infected with dengue, and they can't transmit the virus to people. So it's almost like the concept of finding a probiotic for the mosquito, putting it in the mosquito's tummy, and then the mosquito cannot be infected with the dengue virus. I have always loved science fiction, and one of the threads in science fiction is the development of biological machines and using nature to fight nature. Of course, I use that often enough in my discussions about probiotics and commensals, but here's another example of using it deliberately, and this could be huge. If this can be done relatively inexpensively and it spreads easily, we might be able to really save a lot of human lives all over the world by reducing or even eliminating dengue fever. Another research discovery this week that is quite interesting is that researchers have identified the gene that is probably one of the first genes that has to mutate in order for you to get cancer. This gene is named STAG2. About 20% of brain cancers, skin cancers, bone cancers don't make this protein because they have a mutated version of it. The STAG2 gene encodes a component of protein structure called the cohesion complex, which causes the chromosomes to stick together properly during cell division. So if the separation of the duplicated chromosomal material does not occur correctly, then the two daughter cells will have an uneven number of chromosomes, or a segment of chromosome will break off and go with one cell, leaving the other cell not an identical twin, but instead a cell lacking information. And this, of course, leads to further mutations. And you can see cancer as a series of cumulative mutations, with the cells themselves developing a higher and higher probability of mutation at each stage. So they are trying to see if they can now target all cells with these STAG2 mutations. This might be possible, and if it can be done, it represents a very unique, specific target for a lot of cancers. It's also possible that we may be able to correct this mutation. And in fact, the investigators using, and then I want to emphasize this is purely in the test tube, we're nowhere near animal studies yet, but they were able, using a viral vector, to put the STAG2 back in there and therefore fix a cancer cell, turning it back into a normal cell. Again, in the test tube, but it looks like they've come upon a serious handle in this complex process. We're going to go to our next caller now, and that is Sheila. Hello, Sheila. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Dawn. Good morning.
Good morning.
There's three separate little questions here for you. One is, really glad to hear the hospice folks on the air. And one area of hospice I've learned about that I'm not hearing mentioned here, and I've only heard it from a friend who lives with some people who work for hospice, is the palliative arm, helping people who have been through the cancer experience but not necessarily been all the way to the door.
In other words, people who are not officially dying.
And their families.
Yes.
I don't know what they call it, but it's a part of the journey through life-threatening disease, which may not actually be right to death, but yet all the fatigue and everything that you just mentioned that described my life and their children, et cetera. And it's local hospice, and I've had, you know, the numbers written down, and you're not going to be too shocked here. Too busy to check it out so far, but I just hope to plug it and get the two women to address it for everybody, including myself.
Okay, so palliative, a discussion of palliative care and the services it provides for people who are not expected to be dead within 6 months, which is the strict criteria for hospice enrollment.
Right, what we normally associate with hospice.
Yes, okay.
That's the first thing. Second thing is, my friend who's helped me quite a bit in this journey has lost her husband to cancer, and she has a biofeedback machine called the Indigo, and I don't recall ever hearing you discuss this or talk about it, but if you could look into it, it's a wonderful machine. It helped, she put both my husband and myself on it, and it read some huge number of readings about us, and gave different clues as to vitamin deficiencies and need for chiropractic, and, you know, it gave feedback to those areas.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can address that at a future show or any time. And then the third thing, which comes and goes out of my brain right now, blood types. Do you subscribe to different diet and nutrition strengths for different blood types?
Okay, let me take that last one first on the blood types.
Thank you so much.
I think that there's probably some correlation with blood types and your ethnic origin, when you're Northern European, that sort of thing.
Okay.
And so probably along for the ride, statistically speaking, you have tendencies that are also racial tendencies. Like, for example, if you come from Northern Europe, you don't lose your ability to digest milk in adulthood. If you come from Africa and you're not a Maasai, you probably lose your ability to digest milk by the time you're in your early 20s and develop lactose intolerance. And there are probably, I would expect, different blood type frequencies in those populations. And so you could come up with a correlation of certain types of food intolerances and food benefits that would sort of work statistically. In terms of clinical practice, I just think that there are too many other variables and fine-tuning for something as, well, gross, and I mean gross in the sense of large and crude, of a indicator to really have much predictive power for an individual. And I think when I've looked at the websites and stuff on this, it's mostly based on some pretty soft science.
Okay.
And it's based on epidemiology and statistics, which you can easily lie with. I'm not saying they're lying. I'm saying they find the correlation, but correlation doesn't necessarily have much value, even if it's statistically significant. Like, let's say there's a 50% chance that you're going to go X versus Y, and I can alter that 50% chance by 5%. So now it's 45 to 55. So that's not very much, really.
Right.
But if I have enough people that I do that with, I can get statistically significant.
But if you're making the choice on
an individual basis, it's like, okay, 45 to 55 is still pretty much 50-50.
And you just go there and find out for yourself where you land.
Right. So if someone wants to try losing weight, then they want to go on the eat for your blood type diet, they'll lose weight initially because they've disrupted their standard eating pattern. And if they stay on just about any weight-loss diet, you will lose weight. The question, is it easier? I mean, the question would be, is it easier and is it more effective? And if it's working for you, then I have no argument with it. But it's not my first go-to place. in blood typing, there's just so many other things that have to be looked at that to me this throws a lot of cold water on the hypothesis.
Right.
Okay.
And yet, in your general terms of talking to people about their health, you would have them check their allergies in general if they're having distress.
I would. I routinely check food sensitivities, although I don't call them food allergies. Because I don't...
Sensitivities?
Yeah, I don't like getting into an argument over the meaning of the word allergy.
Okay.
And if you say food allergy to an allergist, or you say celiac disease to a gastroenterologist, then you spend the next 20 minutes having a semantics argument.
Right. And
it's
I appreciate how you avoid those.
I don't need to push the button on the semantics argument. You know, it's right. Like, no... You know, we're not talking about the entity you think we're talking about. We're talking about something else. Here's the else. Here's what...
And your top foods to be on the lookout for sensitivities?
Wheat, soy, corn. The absolute mainstream of the American junk food diet.
Okay. Okay. Well, I thank you so much.
And thank you for the call.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye. Hello, Debbie, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, good. Would you like to respond to that question about palliative care that the last caller had?
I would, but I didn't hear it.
Okay.
If you could paraphrase it for me, that'd be great.
Sure. Basically, what she had said was she wanted to emphasize the importance of not being palliative care, but being people who were just very depleted from their cancer therapy, who might conceivably not die within 6 months, but still needed support.
So her question was,
about the palliative care services.
Okay,
she'd had a cancer diagnosis and therapy and had palliative care that helped her a lot.
Absolutely. When hospice originated in the United States, when we talked about palliative care, we were talking about hospice care. They were one and the same. But over the last decade or so, there's been a growth of a movement identified as palliative care that's unique from hospice care that is physician-driven primarily and originated in the hospital setting. And the palliative care service that's offered there is extremely valuable to those people who have a chronic life-limiting illness, but whose prognosis or her life expectancy could be much longer than 6 months if everything worked the way we thought it might. And so the palliative care services are physician-driven, and they consult with people about the choices they have in care and also start those conversations about advanced care planning that includes not only your physical care, but also supportive services, planning for what you want to happen as you do get close to the end of your life. And generally, it's done in conjunction with a physician and or a nurse practitioner or a physician's assistant and a social worker.
And people who are in this sort of palliative care program could also be people who are actively getting chemotherapy or radiation therapy with the intention of fighting their cancer?
Yes.
A little shaky on that.
Absolutely. So the palliative care is a medical specialty. It's actually now a medical subspecialty. So it would be like having a consult with a GI doctor about a stomach illness.
Mm-hmm.
So your attending physician is still your primary care physician, and they call in another physician group, a physician and generally a nurse practitioner. And so you can pursue the therapies that you choose based on your disease process. That's not impacted. What the palliative care team will do is work with you on symptom management around sometimes those very treatments,
mm-hmm.
but also begin to talk to you about choices in treatment, because oftentimes we are disempowered in our current healthcare system and don't realize actually that we do have choices.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
So they open up those conversations.
Very good. I remember reading about a new breakthrough medication that gave people 2 extra months in their terminal pancreatic cancer, I believe it was, then went on and listed all the side effects, and the primary one I thought was kind of funny was fatigue and nausea. And so it's like, oh, great, 2 months of fatigue and nausea, extra. Yeah, it's like, okay, is this necessarily a benefit?
Well, you know, interesting that you should say that about 2 extra months in a miracle drug. Actually, in 2007, Duke University did a study of patients who had hospice care with certain diseases. And they found actually in some diseases that having hospice care actually prolonged life,
uh-huh.
and some significantly, and it was about 60 to 70 days for end-stage heart disease and for some cancers, and pancreatic cancer happened to be one of them. So actually sometimes getting involved with hospice care and opening up choices and stabilizing your care through having, as you mentioned earlier, someone in the home frequently who's collaborating with the physicians, mm-hmm. can actually extend your life.
Well, part of it may just be elimination of severely toxic, what do they call it, a Hail Mary pass in football?
Yes, absolutely.
We do that way too often in oncology, in my opinion. Well, thanks for that, and I'm putting you back on hold. We're going to take another caller.
Thank you.
Let's go to Judith in Watsonville. Hello, Judith. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling about grieving. I recently lost my little dog, who's been a very significant part of my own life, and he's been my exercise buddy as I've been dealing with some of my own health issues. And my question is sort of for your guest about what are some of the things that might be helpful in terms of the process of grieving. Right now, I think I'm having a hard time really believing that he's dead. I mean, I know he's buried in the backyard, and, you know, we did that, but I think part of me still is in that denial process.
How long ago did you lose your pet?
About a week and a half, 2 weeks ago.
Okay. Go ahead, and I'm going to sign off with you, and we'll put it to Debbie, okay?
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Okay, Debbie, you're back on, and we have a question about grieving.
Okay.
And essentially, a caller lost a very dear pet not too long ago and is in an early stage of grief where half of her brain doesn't want to accept that her friend is dead, and intellectually she buried him, so she knows he's dead. And I think someone who, with a very new loss, looking for some advice about working through grieving and loss.
So grief is a uniquely personal experience, and while we can talk about it generally, I would encourage individuals to reach out to professionals or organizations like our community grief support for more specific counseling and coaching that would meet their needs. But in general, I think one of the most important things we can do when we have a loss is give ourselves permission to grieve, which we often don't do in our culture, where we have a certain, okay, we've had 3 days off from work, or we have a little break in time, and then it's time to get on back to normal. So recognizing that it doesn't work like that, and finding a way and a path to communication, to talk about your feelings, to not isolate and feel you're the only one, or feel the distance that you can from the rest of the world when your heart is breaking and people seem to be having normal lives. So my encouragement would be to give yourself permission to grieve and to take the time and space that you need and surround yourself with things that comfort you. And secondly, to reach out and find a pathway for communication, whether it's through a friend or family member or an organization like ours who can help you.
I think I want to throw in something about the communication piece, because particularly when it's a pet, or maybe you're grieving the loss of a family memento, even. If it's not a human, sometimes you feel very ashamed of expressing grief, and like it's not appropriate for me to care. I had a lady who was having very bad abdominal pain, and was when we finally recognized that she was grieving the loss of a little bird that used to sing for her every morning, and it was just a little bit of joy in her life. And after the bird died, she began having these abdominal pains, and medically there was nothing wrong with her, and had irritable bowel labels and all sorts of things before she finally came to me. And a little bit of acupuncture and a little bit of love and acknowledgement was enough to help. You know, the mind and the body, in my view, are intimately connected. So when people say, well, is this in my head? It's like, of course, you're in your head,
right?
So where else would it be?
Sure. And now it's in your bones. And interesting also, it made me think of something that we often overlook, is that grief is a cumulative process. And we have many losses in our life. And as you mentioned, some of them are losses that are observed and acknowledged by everyone. And we have rituals around those. And some of them are losses that are private, silent losses, but they're losses none the same. And if we have not grieved them, then they do settle in our bones and bodies and create physical symptoms and emotional symptoms that seem unrelated to what's happening in our life right now, but it's the accumulation of loss over time.
That's excellently well put. Oh, I had an off-air comment from someone. I want to read this. For many people, writing can help. That is, write poetry or a story about the lost person or pet. I would also say, you know, digging out photographs. One of my very dear friends made a wonderful photo collage working through the loss of his partner to cancer. It's hard to look at. In fact, he gave it to me because he really didn't want to look at it. But having made it, was a very healing thing. So I just want to throw that on out. Let's go to Vince in Capitola. Hello, Vince. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, hello, doctor. This isn't exactly with hospice care, but
it's
sort of an end-of-life thing. I had a recent first-time occurrence of shingles.
Yes.
And I wonder if you could speak to the different, there seems to be two different drugs, a newer one and an older one, and dose, generalized ideas, and then also for prevention. I know of some friends who, once you get this initial outbreak, the nerve pain remains.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if you could talk to those issues. And also a very weird thing within this county, at least, is the extreme differences in how much the drugs cost. Hundreds of dollars difference.
Now, I think that may not be just in this county. I have a feeling that part of our terribly coordinated healthcare system. But let's take shingles in general is chicken pox. And most of us either had chicken pox as children or were immunized. If you're in the younger generations, we've had chicken pox vaccines now for about 20 years, using those widely. And we're now seeing that population subdivide into those who had the chicken pox vaccines and those who actually got chicken pox. We are still waiting to see whether the shingles rate in the vaccinated childhood vaccination group is better than the shingles rate in the natural infection group. And there are reasons to believe it might be less frequent in those who are vaccinated, but we're going to need 50 years to answer that question. In a shingles case, what is happening is that virus from the chickenpox, the original infection, living in dormancy in the body. It likes to live in nerves, and particularly nerves along the backbone. So it will sleep, and then something makes it wake up. Usually the immune system is distracted. There's a failure of immune surveillance. The virus starts to multiply. It takes over the cells, that nerve cell's cellular machinery, and it's very bizarre, like a parasite, really. It will run down the nerve to the skin that the nerve serves, and when it gets to the skin, it starts budding off viruses, and it creates a bubbly rash, which is full of chickenpox virus. If someone who's never had chickenpox contacts that material from the shingles, they will get chickenpox, which is a respiratory illness initially. They will not get shingles. So it's contagious, but it's not contagious as the manifestation that you're currently looking at. There are old drugs. Zovirax, which is acyclovir, has been around since 1988. It's given in doses of like 800 milligrams 4 or 5 times a day. It's effective against shingles at those doses. It's primarily used at lower doses for prevention of herpes simplex, which is a genital herpes and the first cousin to chickenpox. The other drugs, Valtrex and Famvir, which is valacyclovir and famacyclovir, are very similar compounds. They are not yet generic. If it is not generic, it is very expensive, and you are looking at hundreds of dollars for shingles treatment. We treat as early as we can, because if you don't get treated early, then you are at higher risk of suffering from a persistent sick nerve. In other words, the nerve that carried that infection down to the skin doesn't recover fully and has abnormal action potentials. We're going to have to leave it there. But if you want to call back and talk more about this topic next week, I'll be happy to help.
Thanks so much, doctor.
This is Dr. Don saying so long and stay healthy.